Welcome back to the Munich and Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel. With me tonight is Shane Sentner.
Yo.
And Pierce Bauer.
What's up?
Here at the Munich and Movie Club, we're a group of friends who basically randomly select three movies. And over the course of a month, we watch those movies and write reviews of them at munichmovie.club, our website. And then at the end of the month, we get together to discuss said movies in a podcast. This last month, we watched Captain Fantastic, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar, and Spotlight. Only one of these movies had a talking crab doing a Morgan Freeman accent. We'll let the viewer guess which one. Maybe it was Captain Fantastic, our first movie. This is a movie directed by Matt Ross, who's probably best known as Gavin Belsom from Silicon Valley. This is his first time as a director, and it's a movie about Viggo Mortensen raising, in his words, a clan of philosopher kings out in the Pacific Northwest forest. They're leftists and they're outdoorsmen, and they have to return to society when his wife commits suicide in a mental institution. Let's get some initial thoughts on what we thought about Captain Fantastic. Pierce, why don't you go first?
So this was one of the ones I didn't have a chance to rewatch, but I did see it when it first came out in 2016. And I thought it was pretty, weirdly, like at the time I really liked it, and then it kind of faded from my memory. So I'm interested what you both think, because I liked it when I first saw it. And I think Viggo Mortensen is really good in it, especially for like a kind of atypical Viggo Mortensen role. When you think of him, he's usually like pretty serious or like wrestling naked, you know? So like, I like that this movie was like a change up for him, but it's something I would like to revisit. I just haven't. But when I first saw it, I really liked it. So it's fun. And I thought, like, you know, I didn't know the guy from Silicon Valley directed it. And so I really, that's like a kind of sadder thought, is that I would have liked to see him do more, because I like the movie.
Shane, Captain Fantastic.
I liked it a lot, and I still like it.
Yeah, Pierce, you talked about how it didn't linger. Like, this movie, I saw this in 2016 when it was in theaters, and it like continued to linger over the last 4 or 5 years since then. This is a movie that I really appreciate. And we're going to like dig into why exactly that is. I remember reading negative reviews at the time that this movie, you know, you think about the average person who's going to watch an indie movie that isn't getting a wider release. You know, it's like it's going to land in major cities, major markets, and probably not trickle down into smaller areas. The idea that this is a leftist family, they celebrate Noam Chomsky Day instead of Christmas. If they were raising their kids in a different fashion, we would obviously feel differently about this movie. We're all pretty much on the same, like, political page. Do you think there's a lot of ideas this movie is, like, pushing onto the viewer, but that sense of living in isolation, like, if they were preppers or Mormons living on the wrong side of the Grand Canyon, would this movie be fundamentally different? Like, could it just the exact same plot happen?
I think so, because you have someone, I mean, he's picked an idealization with his kids, and the conflict is his kids don't really know how to operate in society correctly. So I think that can go all over the place on how, you know, if someone's raising their kids off the grid, no matter what, I don't think you're going to have, the ideology just doesn't need to match up with yours to get what it would be like to be in that family.
It's just, it's hard to imagine a movie like that having a tone as light as this one. It would be a darker film if he was raising his daughters to be sister wives.
Yeah, but you also probably end up poking fun at the religion or the school of thought with that as well.
I feel sure. Like
it's going to be that absurd, or you know, because this isn't absurd. This is taking that. This is what it's. We're talking about philosophy, like, you know, it's going to sound smart no matter what with what we're talking about. So you're always going to be on the side, right? Which I guess is probably one of the criticisms in the movie.
Well, I mean, that's another good question, is like, does this movie think that Viggo Mortensen's character, Ben Cash, is he absurd? Is he raising his children in an absurd way?
I guess like part of it is the idea that, like, and maybe this is just my own, I don't know, politics bleeding into it, but like, I think what the comparison you're talking about of like an extreme leftist versus a extreme, you know, conservative or whatever, you know, at the root of it, this like anti-capitalist lifestyle he's trying to live is like at its core, like that is correct, right? It's just a matter of like the cost of that, like Shane said, like the cost of, you know, assimilating into society that these children will have to do one day, right? So it's like, I guess for me, it's this idea of ultimately like his ideals are correct, but in reality, it's impractical, right? It's like the collision of those two things.
Yeah. And I think that's where I question how much I like this movie, because I wonder how much it's flattering me.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be awesome to have a discussion, like a mature, non-giggly discussion about like Lolita with your teenage kid? Wouldn't that be great? Or wouldn't it be awesome to like sit around the campfire and have and people could disagree, but like a non just regurgitated discussion about the difference between Trotskyism and Maoism around the campfire with your children? Like that level of like academic rigor and not treating children like idiots. Like Shane, you've heard me talk to children before.
Yes.
Like,
really,
like treating children like idiots. I hate it.
I agree. You do a nice job of treating my children like adults.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to go about it.
Yeah, you shouldn't have asked them to run in the store to get you beer, though, because they're not adults.
I mean, if I give them enough cash and I give them my ID and I tell them and they're supposed to tell the cashier it's for me, then I don't see what the problem is.
You forgot to tell them to put a jacket on over themselves when they're doubled up as two people.
I can't be responsible. That's
implied.
They should know what the temperature is when they go outside and whether they're going to be comfortable or not. I can't be responsible for that. So yeah, the question or the comment in there is, I don't really know.
Please keep that in.
Yeah, so this movie, I think it's my one criticism is that this movie is a little too much on his side for the most part, and I think they kind of let him off the hook at the end. So it is kind of, when it does agree with you, you're going to say I like this movie a little bit more, and that's why it's going to keep it from, you know, it's being a straight A or A plus.
Sure. And like the rhetorical response to that, I guess, would be like, Is there a difference between a kid getting a concussion in like an organized football game versus a kid falling off a roof trying to rescue their brother from their wealthy grandfather?
I mean, I think that's a pretty obvious yes.
probably, but it's not like the traditional American way of raising children is like a no risk, no harm. If anything bad happens, then take them away.
Right. And I don't, you know, and even I think every parent right before they're about to have a kid, every, you know, like I would say probably higher educated liberal is like, this is what I'm going to do to my kid. I'm going to teach him all this awesome stuff. And then life hits you and kids are exhausting and you can't ever sleep and your brain doesn't function. So you can't do what he's doing in this movie.
The period of time I was watching your older child over this last year, I would come home and sleep.
Yeah. It's exhausting. They don't stop. There's no stopping.
I always kind of knew this, but just the amount of like mental, and Pierce, you can talk to this too as a teacher, but a teacher of teenagers, but still, just the amount of mental energy it takes to stay engaged is significant.
Mm-hmm.
And it translates into physical energy.
Yes. Yeah, it absolutely does.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, like you said, John, yeah, as a teacher, it is like a performative engagement that you have to put on, right? Is that what you're kind of saying?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. God. I can't imagine if I was like a math teacher and I had to bring the same amount of enthusiasm to an identical algebra problem in the morning as I did at the end of the day after teaching it like 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, that's a good, you do have to, yeah, you do just repeat the same thing like 3 times a day. And like kind of put on the same performance. Yeah.
And what Ben Cash is doing here is he's like one room schoolhousing it and like it's one teacher to 6 students. Mm-hmm. So, you know, not and not comparable necessarily, but he's having the same conversation. He's having the same level of instruction with his oldest kid while his youngest kid is in the room, whether he absorbs anything or not, or whether that is the youngest kid's, you know, task for the week. It doesn't really matter. Like, he's still soaking it in and he's not having to repeat himself. And like, it's just that act of repeating it yourself and like bringing your kids up to your level of interest as opposed to bringing yourself down to them, I think makes his life a little more manageable. We're talking about this movie in like a very aspirational way. And I can't help but think of the people that would watch this movie and don't view it to be aspirational. Like, does it just fail on that?
Who do you think doesn't think it's aspirational? What group?
Any conservative person.
Okay. So I would even push back against that, because I think there are a lot of what would label as conservative would see this and be like, see, that's a good life. That's what you're supposed to do. Like, know how to do X, Y, and Z. Because there's a lot of,
that's
not
fair.
Just the philosophy, but these guys can survive on their own. Like, you know, a lot of conservatives are always talking about, right? The people who would push back the most, I feel like people are people who live in suburbs and just don't get it.
Yeah, we got to talk about Catherine Hahn and Steve Zahn, Ben's brother-in-law and sister, and their two children. I find that to be the most frightening anti-example in the movie. Like, it's those characters that are the worst, with minor exceptions that we'll get into a little later. The movie doesn't think the parents are bad. They're not bad parents necessarily. They're just tired and working and only have so much energy. Their children are, I think the movie thinks the children are awful. Do you guys think that's fair, or are they like, or is Matt Ross like putting his finger on the scale?
So from what I recall, and like, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but like, so the Catherine Hahn, Steve Zahn family, they're just like very suburban, right?
Yes.
That's like the whole, and their kids are just like shitheads, right?
They play video games and they're snotty.
Right.
And Ben humiliates them by asking them what the Bill of Rights is, and then brings his youngest daughter down, and she like has not a regard. Sidebar, but I think these kids are very naturalistic. I think when they say they think something, they really do think it, and they're just not regurgitating received wisdom.
I guess. Right.
Do you guys agree with that?
I recall that scene now. Yeah. Okay. So I guess, I don't know if this was your question exactly, but for me, I do recall, now that I think back on the movie, that I do think it is a bit of a like very kind of forced dichotomy. Of putting up the two kind of like, not even extremes, but in the case of Viggo Mortensen's family versus just like the most shithead suburban family, the idea that there isn't like a middle ground, you know, but maybe that's just coming from myself who grew up in like a like liberal city, you know, cities like Asheville exist, right? It's not like you're, if you are going to not live in the woods, you have to live in like a mansion out in like the, you know, cookie cutter suburbia. So I guess if that's what you were talking about, I guess I do remember that from the movie, and kind of do think it's a bit of a, I don't know, maybe cheap kind of like forced dichotomy.
Those are comedic scenes, but the takeaway is that Ben's kids are top to bottom just better in every conceivable way. Because we only see the cousins in their home. We don't see that they probably have friends. They probably have like group activities, extracurriculars that they do. They might be dumb as shit when it comes to civics, but we're only seeing a portion of their lives. I'm so totally on the movie's wavelength in those scenes though, that I don't trust my reaction because like that's the theme of this discussion, is like this movie works for me so well, I don't trust it. I feel like I'm being preached to, and I'm in the choir saying amen.
Yeah, I see. I didn't even think it treated that family so poorly.
Oh gosh, I so did.
It didn't treat them great. It definitely didn't treat the kids great, but it just, but those kids in that family are so much more relatable. So,
I mean, like that comes back to the aspirational nature of the movie. Like, if they're relatable, what does that say about us?
Right. Well, I just, the reaction to that lifestyle is they're not out there. They don't know what's going on. And the only thing you hear is guys, you know, raising kids in the woods. It doesn't sound good offhand.
Is it possible to watch this movie coming back to the aspirational nature as a parent or a teacher and not feel like it's pointing its finger at you?
Yeah, as a parent, I don't feel like it's pointing my finger at me at all. Not the least bit. It's, I guess, more of a society, but I just took much more of the movie was you can teach all these things and you can be book smart and have all these things, but what does it mean if you can't operate in the world? So, because ultimately the son goes off to college and it is what it is.
He goes off to Africa.
Or Africa, that's right, Africa, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, it is like a thing of like, I think that's the right, you nailed it. It's like this idea of like learned behavior versus like book smart. Those like intangible things that can only be taught through real life experience. And again, like that is a takeaway I had from the movie that like Shane used like exactly what you just said.
I think like the unreformed Ben Cash would say, what is the value of joining a society as sick as this one?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And reasonable people can disagree on the sickness of the society. So like, the point is there are multiple ways to raise your kids and they're probably all going to turn out okay.
What is like, it's like the, to reference a meme, but like there's the meme, it's like a political cartoon of like someone saying like we should like improve society, and then someone else being like, but you participate in it, you know?
Yes.
Right. Like it is that like really like on paper, yes, like it's you, how can you be critical of something and participate in it? But like in reality, that's like the nature of life, like, you know, that's just how the world has to operate, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. As far as the family itself, is there like an appropriate amount of conflict for like a family of this many teenagers? Like the oldest three, the Bonavon and the two girls whose name I don't have off the top of my head, they're very much in lockstep with the mission. And then there's a single outlier with Raelian. Surely, like, he's on the cusp of being a teenager. Surely those other three had their moments of rebellion. We just don't see them in the movie. What do you think the movie would have been improved by more, like, disunity? Or is there, like, the right amount?
No, I think there's the right amount. It just shows here. Because I think everyone, if there was no kid wanting to leave, everyone would be like, the audience would say, what would this guy do if one of his kids tried to rebel and leave? It shows that. And so all you need is just the one to show that. But you're also showing how close of a bond siblings like that could have. So if you have them all chaotically fighting, what kind of bond would they have? So it kind of goes just it's shorthand. And I think it works for this movie.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The movie can only be so long. And there's plenty of conflict in the rest, like the I guess you would say the normal world against them that you don't necessarily need more. That's just something that stuck out to me. I want to sing a little praise for Viggo Mortensen, who is doing all that he can to equalize the scales of male and female cinematic nudity. Pierce, you mentioned naked wrestling, perhaps the most aggressive male nudity of the 21st century in movie. Yeah. Eastern Promises, great movie. And we get a little Mortensen cherry on the top of that sundae here. It's like him and Michael Fassbender, just naked. Mm-hmm. Can get their dong out the most in movies. Whose dick has more credits? Viggo Mortensen's or Michael Fassbender's? Yeah. I'll have to check IMDb for that one. We haven't mentioned Frank Langella and Ann Dowd's character. She's a nice older woman in this movie. She's very kind to her grandchildren. She's very kind to her son-in-law, in spite of everything. I find Langella repulsive.
Yes. Yes.
In a way that the movie doesn't go out of its way to make him look. The movie allows him to be fun with his grandchildren, at least. He's not a pure villain. but I find him villainous.
Yeah, it's pretty pretty inexcusable, that behavior. Absolutely inexcusable.
That brings us to our last question. What's the worst thing that could be done with your body after you die?
Well, it would have been Dingo Eats Me.
You outlasted him.
But I've outlasted Dingo now, so I don't have to worry about him eating me. But probably the ghost of Dingo coming back and eating me.
This podcast will end with an in memoriam tribute.
it's just the sound of a dog licking his butt.
With a totally contra song playing. It won't be anything sad, like from Sarah McLachlan. It'll be like Randy Newman, I Love LA, or something like that.
That's great, yes.
And that would get the most listens of any of the podcasts ever.
Yes, there you go.
The worst thing that we know in my body is what happens to the wife's body. I can't imagine anything more offensive and insulting than an aggressive atheist having a religious funeral. The aggressive atheist, of course, knows that there's nothing there anymore. The person is gone. It's just meat that's left behind. But that just feels so hateful. You wouldn't know anything about it, obviously. You're dead. There's no spirit. There's no soul. You're gone. It was in your head, and your head is rotting and filled with chemicals if you're treated as terribly as that woman was. But yeah, it just feels so offensive to me.
I was not prepared for that question.
Okay. Yeah, take your time.
Yeah, you know, I'll think about it. I guess it would be an unfavorable, like, if I were cremated and then, like, my ashes were scattered. I'm trying to think what would be, like, the worst place for my ashes to be scattered. And I can't decide. I'm trying to think what was my least favorite place on Earth. And it's tough to decide, right?
Yeah. Like a rival sports team stadium or something.
Maybe something like that. Or maybe just like, I don't know. Yeah, just like I'm just like thrown out in the dumpster behind an Arby's.
See, that sounds fine. That sounds perfectly fine to me.
Yeah, as I was saying it, I kind of liked it actually.
Which I think is what the will of Mrs. Cash states. Cremate me and throw my ashes. No, flush my ashes down a truck stop toilet or something to that effect.
Mm.
This is what they end up doing. So it's a happy. Yeah,
everything. I'd forgotten that part of the movie. So
yeah, weird. I think that's kind of the way to go. So that's Captain Fantastic. I believe it's available on Amazon Prime. Check it out. It's a thoughtful movie. It's a fun movie. In the meantime, we lost Shane due to a power outage. Maybe he'll return. But we're going to go ahead and move on to our next movie, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. This is a hard-to-describe comedy from Josh Greenbaum directed this, and more importantly, it's written by Kristen Wiig and Annie Mumolo. The basic story is these very cheerful, very friendly Barb and Star. Barb is not short for Barbara, it's just Barb, and Star is a nickname for Starbra. They lose their job at a furniture store, they're kicked out of their neighborhood talking club, and they decide, you know, there's been tying us here, let's glitz our lives up by going to a place that has 24-hour CVS's and Tommy Bahama-clad men, as far as the eye can see, and that is Vista Del Mar. And they get into wacky hijinks. I loved this. I thought this is the best comedy since Pop Star Never Stop Never Stoppin' in 2016. But I understand that of all genres of movies, comedy is unquestionably the most subjective. Brian Hartman, one of our members, he hated this movie in a way that I abstractly understand. The jokes just don't work, but I don't understand how a person could hate this movie. This movie is delightful. Pierce, what did you think of Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar?
So, like, I think it is a good execution of what it is trying to be. It's actually a really good execution of being that just like total slapstick, like SNL, just like taking an SNL character, bit, whatever, sketch, and just like exploding it into a movie and just like, you know, doubling and tripling and quadrupling down on like the same character or bit or joke. That being said, like, it was not like for me. I felt it was just like Kristen Wiig doing the voice, like it just is not my comedy. But that's still like for a comedy movie, which we just do not get a lot of, like genuinely good comedy movies. I thought it was still a pretty good execution for a style of comedy that just like wasn't my bag. But so like overall, like it was, I was not like raving about it the way I think a lot of people were when it first came out, because I think people were really like, this is actually funny and it's kind of getting lost. But I think it's like good. Like I wouldn't say it's terrible. I understood the point, right? I understood, my expectations were pretty set, right? Like I think, and I'm not talking about Brian here, but I guess if you took the movie too seriously going in, I could see how it would be like unwatchable. Right. But I think if you go in expecting like if you go back in the past of like the Mike Myers, the Adam Sandlers, you know, all of those like styles of film or comedy, it is exactly that, you know, just with Kristen Wiig now, you know, taking over.
I saw a lot of Zoolander in this. It was like stupid characters that are stupid, but not mean in the way that like Wedding Crashers and Old School from that same period of time. Like those characters are mean. And none of the jokes here are at anybody's expense, really. They're silly. Like the characters are silly, but they're nice people, ultimately. Up to and including the person who is about to exterminate Vista Del Mar with a crowd of GMO mosquitoes released from a submarine driven by a 12-year-old Asian boy. What a crazy sentence. This movie is, it takes bits and pieces from every successful comedy of the last like 30 years and blends them up into something completely new. I didn't watch any Saturday Night Live when Kristen Wiig was there. And like Annie Mumolo's previous writing credits are like Megan Levy and some other equally forgettable movie. They did, of course, write Bridesmaids together. But this is, Bridesmaids is very much like in that Judd Apatow style, like overlong. There are like dedicated character segments with no jokes. Funny, no question. But a lot of breaks for stuff that's not necessarily funny.
Yeah. Or
it's like jokes all the way through. Like this is like a 30 Rock level of like joke density. Did you watch Kristen Wiig on SNL, and was there like any foreshadowing of this in her characters? Because I have no idea.
So I did in the sense that like I'm aware of kind of her most popular characters, but like I was saying, like none of those ever really landed for me, right? And I think this is in the vein of some of those characters for sure, or at least as like as close as it could be without being like an adaptation of one of her characters from a sketch. But like I think Bridesmaids is great. I think it's truly like some of the funniest scenes of any comedy of the last whatever decade that came out, right? Like that's excellent. And then you're right, which is like this is a different speed. Like this is like Zoolander's a good, you know, comp for it. Like it is total ridiculousness, you know, no sincerity, but still being, I guess, maybe not sincerity, but no, like, seriousness to the plot, right? Which is, you know, goes all the way back.
Stops a bullet with his face, and a magical mermaid named Trish saves it for Barb and Star.
Right, and I liked that. Like, I think that's, you know, there's a place for that, obviously, in big blockbuster comedy is like it should be like, you know, if you go back to like Airplane or like Blazing Saddles or whatever, like I like the swings they took to make it as absurd as possible. Like, I liked that. It's more of the, like, scenes of Kristen Wiig and Annie Mumolo just, like, talking in their accents, you know, and repeating things that, like, just not for me.
I mean, that was just one aspect of a movie that, again, I loved top to bottom. Like, I mentioned the talking crab earlier. It is in this movie and not in Spotlight. It doesn't impart, like, unique wisdom to the character it's talking to. It's just in the movie because it's this incredibly layered joke. Like, first the crab is Morgan Freeman, and then, no, his name is Morgan Freemond, but he's been in all the same movies that Morgan Freeman has been in. And then he crab walks into the ocean and never to be heard from again. Just total non sequitur comedy that doesn't really make its way into movies, because how can it? Like, movies are supposed to move from, like, A to B to C. And when you have these, like, crazy digressions, like Wet Hot American Summer, when they go into town and get hooked on heroin, like, it doesn't impact the movie in any way. You can cut it out and the movie's just, like, that much shorter. But it just adds to, like, the tone of the movie and boosts it in general, because who wouldn't laugh at any of that? It's just, like, totally subverting expectations. Jamie Dornan, a star.
That's a good, like, sneaky casting of, like, you wouldn't expect, you would never think someone like it's, I don't know about you, but, like, I like that in a movie when it's just, like, an actor that you didn't think was, like, down to play ball, just, like, yeah, leans in. Like, John Hamm is the ultimate, right? Like, when John Hamm started doing funny things and you're just like, oh, wow, he can also do that, you know? Like, he's self-aware enough to be funny. So it's always good when that happens.
Yeah, or like Ryan Felipe in MacGruber. Is that one of those? I think this movie asks a lot more of Jamie Dornan than either of John Hamm is very good in Bridesmaids, and we've expressed our love for MacGruber in past podcasts. But Jamie Dornan, wow. I wouldn't say he steals the movie from either Wiig or Mumolo, but I think he arguably has the best scene with his power ballad that he sings to seagulls about his desire to be in an official relationship. He plays everything so straight. He's ultimately just as nice as everybody else. So you can, and, like, the idea of, like, a lovelorn hunk is enough of, like, it's impossible to, like, I haven't seen a 50 Shades of Grey movie, but I would imagine, like, it's impossible to empathize with this billionaire who likes whips and fuzzy handcuffs. I don't know. Again, I've never seen 50 Shades of Grey. The idea that, like, his love interest isn't interested in him. Like, okay, great. You're, like, this incredible physical specimen who has this very relatable problem. Do your jetés and your pliés and dance all over the beach, and we'll be on your side. It's a way to, like, bring this like Hollywood actor in a way that, like, Kristen Wiig and Annie Mumolo, like, they're comedians and are naturally, like, not, they're not, like, Hollywood classic attractive, you know, whereas Jamie Dornan very much is, and they still find a way to make him fit perfectly in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought everybody, like, top to bottom, like,
oh, so god, Damon Wayans Jr.
Hilarious. Yeah, good. Yeah,
Phyllis Smith in the Talking Club doing, like, her horse noises, hilarious. Just makes the absolute most of her screen time. And like, comedies so often come down to editing. Like, every time they flashed back to the Talking Club in the middle of, like, an action scene, hilarious, hilarious. Who wouldn't love that? Again, I understand that comedy is subjective. That's just good and right and correct. And if you don't laugh at it, I don't know what to tell you. This, of course, being a comedy, there just ultimately isn't. There's never going to be as much to say about a comedy as there is about a drama. It's just kind of the way it is. You have anything else about Barb and Star? One more thing. I want to put this in, like, the David Ehrlich nice core category with movies like Paddington, where you just want everybody to be happy at the end of the movie. And everybody in the characters kind of want that for each other as well. Like, it's not, it's an anti-sarcasm movie, or an anti-irony movie. But I think there's certainly a place for.
Yeah, and it's a good friendship movie. You know, if you want to take this sentimental, you know, what is sentimental within it. My final thing, which I saw this going around Twitter a while back, but do you think Don Cheadle has seen this movie?
Is this in relation to, like, Space Jam?
Well, no. So in the movie, don't they love Don Cheadle?
Dude, oh gosh, did I miss that? Yeah, I must have missed that.
I think it's from what I remember. It's like the in-flight magazine, and then I think they reference it. It comes back in the end of the movie. Yeah,
it's a good question. The only thing I remember from the plane trip is just the Trish monologue, which fantastic. Your favorite movie is either Short Circuit or The Ring, so yeah, that makes sense as a person. I don't remember that. I kind of doubt it. This doesn't seem
like
Don Cheadle's bag. I think he would. I've never met Don Cheadle. I might have a complete misunderstanding of his comedic sensibilities, but he seems like he would be in the Brian camp as not getting this movie about absurd white people and one terrible black spy.
Mm-hmm.
Last thing, Florida Vacations, yay or nay? I've had bad ones and I've had good ones.
There's some good beaches, and then vast majority of that state is Mad Max style wasteland. So, no, I sure. Stay away.
The picture of Florida as a place where this hotel, where you're greeted by like a Busby Berkeley musical number, and then you walk a couple, like a block down the street, and you're in like a No Country for Old Men style rat hole. Yeah, that's been my experience, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think the movie does a good job of like nailing a subculture and just like, you know, like everything down to like the like pants they wear, the
lots.
Like, yeah, and the accents and like all of that's what, like the everything they're into does feel like it feels real. Like that's a recognizable person and place at least.
Oh, yeah. It's an homage to everybody's most boring aunt.
Mm-hmm.
Our final movie is Spotlight, the 2016 or 2015 Best Picture winner. I mean, the first question we have to ask about Spotlight is, like, was that the right decision? Because that was the year that The Revenant came out, but most importantly, that was the year when Fury Road came out. I only mentioned The Revenant because it was, like, an Oscar favorite. Incorrectly, if you ask me, but we're not talking about The Revenant. Like, 5 years on, Spotlight winning over Fury Road. Before we get into like the meat of this movie, and there's a lot of it, what did you think about that in the moment, and like what do you think about that now, Pierce?
You know, it's weird. It's the kind of thing where it's like, you know, if you ask me like which one's the better movie, it's certainly Fury Road, right?
I agree with that. Yes,
and like I certainly think it would be, you know, if we were revising history, like it would probably be overall positive for a movie like Fury Road to win Best Picture, you know, almost similar in the way, although very different movies, but like similar to a Parasite in a way where it's something that's outside the standard, you know, mold, right, for Oscar winners. But I do think that like if you look at that decade of Best Picture winners, Spotlight is a good one, you know, and there's so it's shocking how many are just bad, you know, and mm-hmm. so. Like, yes, I think Fury Road over Spotlight is probably an easy yes for me, but I don't disparage Spotlight because it won Best Picture. Like, I think that's still in the canon of Oscar winners. Spotlight's a pretty good one for a pretty mediocre decade of, you know, like, compared to, like, Argo or The Artist. You know, it's like, it's so much better than either of those movies. So, yeah, and
you think about like past Oscar questionable best pictures, Spotlight in no way was diminished by winning over something. And I think most people, the vast majority of people would 5 years on would agree that like Fury Road I remember watching that Oscars with my fingers crossed, like, could this actually happen? And really rooting against The Revenant to win. Mm-hmm. And then when Spotlight wins, I was like, okay, great. Yeah, fine. I'll accept that. That's a perfectly acceptable choice. You compare it to something like The King's Speech winning over Social Network or Forrest Gump over Pulp Fiction or like Dances with the Wolves over Goodfellas. Like, those three movies, those three winners are tainted by being chosen over like riskier stuff. Whereas Spotlight in no way is risky. Not really. But mm-hmm. No one would say a bad word about it, I don't think.
Yeah, I think if anything, that the only knock against it as an Oscar Best Picture winner would be that it is just which is not even a bad thing necessarily, but just the stigma within the Oscars of it is just like a trauma, like headlines, like we're just gonna take like a, you know, not historical fiction, but like that type of like, we've got actors playing real people in this real rip from the headlines event. And it just like, yes, that is maybe a bit formulaic, but I still think Spotlight is just like a really good execution of that type of movie. Like, it really is just a straight down the middle. They just kind of nail it, and with no frills or like, you know, anything remarkably, you know, groundbreaking. It's just a good movie.
It's not flashy. This is a writer's movie first, then an actor's movie, then an editor's movie, and then like a director's movie. This movie was directed by Tom McCarthy, who in probably I gotta assume one of the only times this has ever happened, made arguably one of the best movies of the year and unquestionably the worst movie of the year with The Cobbler, which I don't know if you've seen Pierce, but holy shit, that is a monstrosity of a movie.
Yeah, I missed that one when it came out, so I've never gone back, you know. So
it's arguably the worst thing Adam Sandler has ever done.
Which is saying a lot to some degree.
Yes, it is. Yeah. That's really saying something. But Spotlight, this is a movie I have a deep personal connection to, not because I was molested, but because I did grow up in a strict Catholic family in a very Catholic community. I went to Catholic school for K through 12. I was a junior in high school when all of these revelations came out, and there was a child molester that preyed upon my middle school. So when I was the age that this was happening, I certainly had thoughts about that kind of thing. And I had unresolved thoughts, I guess you would say, or unresolved feelings by the time I saw this movie, to the point where I don't think I've ever cried harder in a movie theater or in public in general than at the end of this movie. I was deeply, deeply affected by it, as unflashy as Spotlight is. Just to see all these facts, and I was well-educated about this whole scandal, too, but just to see all these facts put back up on screen was really affecting in a way that surprised myself then and surprises myself now. I love this movie. I love Spotlight. I had it as my 13th best movie of the decade. Right now, it's like number 4 in our giant database of movies. Quick initial thoughts after all that Oscar talk, Pierce, about Spotlight.
Well, I'll tell you my personal connection to Spotlight and where I was when I first saw it, which is, and this is kind of strange, different from from where you're coming from. But so and you might know this, John, a bit, but like in high school, I was very involved in my student newspaper. That was like my bag. Like I was known, and not in like a cool way, but like I was known as like the newspaper kid. I was the editor in chief.
Yeah.
And so then this movie, I graduated high school in 2014. This movie comes out 2015. So of course, like at that time of my life, I was determined. I thought I was going to be a journalist. And I guess based on this podcast, maybe I kind of am.
That's how I think of myself, certainly.
Yeah.
surprise play.
And that dream came true exactly how I envisioned it. I was like really excited for this movie, and I went to see it, I believe, with my mother, actually, who was like, we gotta go see this. And so of course I was like really into it. And at that time I really liked, I'd seen All the President's Men, and that was like one of my favorite movies, still is. But what you don't know, John, do you know what the name of my high school newspaper was?
I do not.
It was The Spotlight.
Oh boy.
So then this movie came out and I was like, wow, that's crazy. And then this is actually quite kismet, actually. This school year, this upcoming school year, for listeners that don't know, I teach at my old high school. And this school year, I'm taking over the class that is Spotlight, that is the student newspaper.
That's hilarious.
Right. So it is like this weird serendipitous thing that, like, this weird journalistic thing I was involved with. Then this movie comes out with the same name. And so when I saw it, I was also just like, one great movie. I enjoyed, you know, all the, whether it was about a thing I was into or not, I thought it was a good movie. And then two, on a journalistic side, I was also very intrigued by it.
So, like, as a person who has, you know, generated some quotes or uncovered some dirt about, I don't know, new lights for the football stadium or something that cost too much, what did you think about the depiction of a newsroom and of like the work of journalism here?
Your
vast experience.
Well, I will say, yes, high school journalism is funny. But I will say I was quite the renowned journalist at that age. We actually did write a very hard hitting expose on our county possibly losing their accreditation. And we like interviewed like high ranking like board members and the like accreditation agency vice president. It was a whole thing. So we
like it would have been like the Atlanta cheating scandal.
This is true. As high schoolers, me and this other kid, we got an exclusive interview with the head of the DeKalb County board before the AJC, because for some reason this idiot, and truly this man was an idiot, for some reason let us, because he thought we were just going to be two high school kids, let us come interview him. And then we ran, like, before the AJC got to run any stories, we printed ours, but it was this similar, not obviously in the scale of importance, but similar to what they were doing here in the film Spotlight, of just this, like, you know, trailing this big story and, like, the whole thing, right? But as far as the accuracy, I mean, it reflected, it reflected my high school journalism class to a T. I think it nailed it. I do think the movie does do a good job of, like, showing you the kind of, like, foot soldier nature of, like, when, like, Rachel McAdams or Mark Ruffalo are just, like, going out and talking to these people and knocking on doors. And like seeing that whole process from, you know, discovery to like investigation into like, how do we what is the actual story here? And like, what is it that we are reporting? You know, I do think the movie does a good job of breaking all that down. Right. Yeah.
I think this is one of the best screenplays of the 21st century. I would go that far. I would totally understand like disagreement with that. There are certain, like, another movie I would put on that list would be like The Report from 2019, which was about the CIA's torture report, and or like Contagion in a way too. Neither of those movies being as they, like, this movie is about a pedophile scandal, and those two movies are about torture and a global pandemic, but they are also very dry. On their, like, just words on the page, it's very dry, but the movie is able to educate the viewer in a way that educate the viewer and really compel the viewer through the character's urgency. Like, the characters in Spotlight, in the report. A lot of times all they're doing is just reciting data or names you haven't heard of, but it's not jargony. Any viewer could understand exactly what's happening, what's going to happen next, and what could happen next, and where they might go next. And that level of like competence porn is, I appreciate that so much. I'm never going to be a journalist, but I do come away from Spotlight thinking, all right, this is what it would take. And like that's part at the very root, like movies are supposed to be about. Art in general is supposed to be about like putting yourself into someone else's head and experiences, and part of a person's experience is their job. And if you can like realistically portray what a job is like, then your movie is a smashing success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's like you were saying, there's like countless scenes in the movie that feel like thrilling or like action, you know, but like in reality are just like Stanley Tucci explaining how he like recovered some documents through like legal processes, you know, like it is like this. And All the President's Men, I think, is like the best version of this in a way. Yeah, it is this thing of just like turning, like you were saying, like that jargon or the watching the process unfold of something that is inherently not action, but is still thrilling to be a part of.
Yeah. A movie like The Social Network.
Mm.
Does yeah. something like that through its direction.
Yes. Like,
but this Spotlight doesn't do that and therefore becomes almost as, if not more, impressive because it's not relying on like a Trent Reznor techno score
mm-hmm.
to like goose everything or like the incredible editing that's in The Social Network to create the sense of propulsion. Like the sense of propulsion in Spotlight comes from the seriousness of what they're talking about. I do like The Social Network marginally more, but I remember having this conversation with another film guy about Suspiria, not the remake, but the original one. I was like, I could not follow that story for the life of me when I saw that movie for the first time recently. But he, who had seen it a lot of times, was like, well, it's a good thing that movies aren't just about their story. And that's, you know, that sometimes that's a benefit. But here, the story is just so compelling. Like, it gives you the sense of, maybe I'm the only person that gets this feeling, but when I'm in a room or a group that's having, like, an important, meaningful conversation, like, where you're deciding, like, the next course of action, and like, the feeling of, like, decisions being made, there is some kind of, like, tingle in my brain, or like, holy shit, I'm in one of these scenarios again. It doesn't necessarily just happen at, like, work. Happens rarely at work for me, but like it used to happen when like something was clicking for me in class back in college, like in a history class or a biology class or something. And you get that, especially from Liev Schreiber, who plays the editor of the paper in this movie. Like whenever he's talking, you get the feeling that someone is doing the exact right thing. They're making the exact right choice. They have the exact right evidence presented to them by the exact right people. And we're going to move forward from there.
Mm-hmm. To me, it kind of reminds me of like the bad version of this is the newsroom, right? Like the Aaron Sorkin. Oh, gosh.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Or Concussion. I don't know if you saw that movie. Will
Smith. I didn't, but I can imagine that. Yes. That seems similar, right? Where it's like
that movie contains all the things that Spotlight correctly does not have. Mm-hmm. Like people trying to silence the whistleblower. Spotlight has it. It's so much subtler about the way that power works and the way like inertia works. You just put something, you put records, or you reclassify something in like the internal language of your organization. You create confusion where none should exist, and you bury it in a basement. That's all you need to do to keep things from emerging. And like the recurring image in this movie is libraries and like stacks of documents or like wrapped up files in a manila folder. And they just all sit somewhere until someone is moved to pick them up. And like the first half hour of this movie is all of these ways that this story does not get picked up at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be no one's fault it would just be somebody made a decision while they're watching a baseball game, and they're like, I think it's time to move on. There's nothing here. And the person that they're speaking to doesn't push back, and then it's gone.
Yeah. There's
just so much information for like these journalists to potentially turn their focus on that it's easy to miss something. And that's all that power needs to happen, is just to, like, in the Steve Bannon terminology, just flood the zone with shit, and eventually stuff will get lost. And that's exactly what happens here.
Yeah, I think the movie does a good job of not, I guess for lack of a better term, not being too preachy about those, it exposes this power structure, right? And, like, how does this happen, right? Like, how, you know, the abuse of power and in the, like, literal abuse of children, right? And you know, there's that, like, really just, like, gut-wrenching scene or line from the one guy who says, you know, it's not like you're being chosen by him, you're being chosen by, like, God, right? Like, the movie really does a great job of displaying, telling you the story that they are uncovering, right? And, like, making it not understandable, but, like, receivable. Like, that you, again, the message of the story is just very clear without being overtly speechy. Nobody has to stand up and give a grand monologue explaining to you what you're supposed to gather from this. Like, it just does a really good job of translating directly to you as you watch it.
Yeah. And, like, the one exception to that, I think, is the film's worst scene in A Runaway, where it's Ruffalo, who, Mark Ruffalo is a great actor. He's been in a lot of great things. I think he's the worst in the main cast here. I don't know what Phil Resendez looks like in real life, the character he's playing. I don't know how he like holds his jaw in real life, but Ruffalo clearly met this guy, and he clearly watched videos of this guy, and he clearly is like incorporating tics into his performance that we know the real Mark Ruffalo doesn't have in other movies. It's just very actorly, in a way that is distracting, and to give him the big blow ups, the one single speech of anybody raising their voice, it's just a mistake. The movie does not need it.
Yes and no, right? So, like, I think, one, it's an all-time great overacting performance. Just, like, it's the all-time heat check. Ruffalo, for one scene, just, like, anytime he gets the ball, just chucking it up. But, I rewatch that scene, often, because I just like it. I do think, like, the sentiment behind it, the idea that he's expressing, is important for the sake of the movie, right? This idea of, like, the cost of running the story too early in order to expose versus, like, waiting so that the whole system can be, you know, liable or caught together, right? But it's, like, but it is just, like, a pure bit of overacting in just, like, a very timid movie for the most part, right? Like, it just feels so much louder because the movie is not that. But I don't know. I think outside of that one moment, I think his performance is good. I think, if anything, for me, it's Keaton is doing the least, not that he's bad, but he's doing the least, acting. Like, there are scenes where it just feels like Keaton, right? And especially with the Boston dynamic, too, I don't know if his Boston accent is good. But, you know, that's all. That's a nitpicky thing, maybe. But I just think,
I feel like anybody's really trying for the accent.
But he's the only one he's the only one that's supposed to be from Boston. Right? Or at least, like, overtly, they go out of their way in the movie to talk about, you know, that
his roots are deepest.
Right. And just as a way of, you know, that character's connection to the community and the church that he's reporting on, you know, that matters to that character. So I guess, you know, it does matter to a degree that guy feels like, you know, he's from that neighborhood, right? But, you know, I just don't know if Keaton really, not that, again, not that he's bad in the movie, but he, I don't know if he fills that role precisely.
Yeah. As far as other performances, Liev Schreiber, he's excellent, but he's doing nothing. He's just projecting an air of like wisdom and competence that maybe it's the beard, I don't know. He doesn't seem like he's doing anything. He doesn't get excited. He doesn't raise his voice. There's barely any inflection in his voice. But he's just always right. In a way that I like when we were talking about Captain Fantastic, it's like, is this movie too nice? Like, I don't trust my reaction to these characters. I completely trust my reaction to Marty Baron and like his continual putting off and putting off and putting off of publishing until they're ready to go. I just automatically believe that he's correct. And he has to convince the other journalists, of which he's not, of which he's like a newcomer. He has to convince them and the viewer as well that he's doing the right thing, that they're too close to it. They're not making the right choice. He's going to make the right choice. And despite Ruffalo's big blow up, like, he does convince Lifer, Michael Keaton, and he convinces me too. I didn't think that was my favorite. I really like Keaton, but that could be just because I like Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
As you're on a rewatch, I don't know what he's doing, but he's just so impressive. Liev Schreiber.
Yeah. Very reserved. I think the whole cast is like really well, like a well cast movie. But like in like even like Stanley Tucci, who like is always good, but and Billy Crudup, but even like the smaller roles of like the guy, Phil Saviano, the guy who like in with the box, you know, he's the guy who originally kind of reported or called them up and
they reported on it. But he's running a survivors group and he's assembling, right. He's keeping track of a lot of stuff.
Right, like that's a really just good one scene. Like he's in a couple scenes, but that one scene he has just like really good casting. All the you know, the victims now grown up, I think, are like really good, just like small character parts that they cast really well. And I really like the other guy who's part of the news team, Brian Darcy James. Yeah, I have no idea what else I would ever know him from, but he's like, again, like the movie's just really good at these kind of reserved performances, but he's good at like not being, you know, the flashy lead, but he's just like another good casting, you know.
I love how anti-triumphant this whole movie is. Like Matt Zoller on the Wikipedia page, like the digest of reviews, the last one, because they saved the negative ones for last, Matt Zoller cites, who's like the head critic on RogerEbert.com, or I don't know what he's doing now. But he's like a major critic. He compared this movie to The Post, as like The Post being a better movie. The Post also being written by Josh Singer, the writer, along with Tom McCarthy of Spotlight. But The Post is all triumphalism. It has a scene with like a triumphant newsroom throwing their papers in the air while one of the reporters reads out the court ruling in their favor.
So
it's totally hokey. Complete bullshit. That significantly diminished that movie for me when that scene happened. And I liked parts of The Post a lot. I think it had some great insight. But Spotlight ends with just more on the horizon. Like, we put up the first story, the phones are ringing. You don't do the biopic thing where you show the real people compared to like the actors and like what a job Mark Ruffalo did with Resendez's facial tics. You don't see that they won Pulitzers for this. All you see is that it was uncovered in hundreds of other places around the world.
Yes. So The Post was not a movie I thought to compare to it. That's a movie I did not like. And I think it's for that reason of that kind of like self-aggrandizing, like pat on the backness of it all. And then with the one I was thinking about, because you're right, like that, I think that really, when you get down to it, like obviously the screenplay, the performances are all really good, but I think that the final decision to end on that moment in the film, not the, like you said, like the pat on the back, look at all the awards we won, look at the real people, but the fact to, like, the, it's such a, I don't know if this makes sense, but it's like, it proves that this movie, the filmmaker, everybody had an understanding of the purpose of this film, which was not just to retell a story from recent history, but to make a point about this ongoing issue that exists in our world, right? So, like, I was thinking about Trial of the Chicago Seven, right, to go back to Sorgan, which is a movie that ends similarly with the triumphant, you know, at the end he reads, spoiler, I guess, but it doesn't matter, really. Don't feel bad about that movie. But it ends with him reading the names of everybody who was killed in Vietnam over the course of that trial, right? And it ends with everyone cheering and clapping in the courtroom. And then it just is like a triumphant victory at the end of the film. Instead of being a movie about how this, you know, these issues in our legal system and issues with the police are ongoing still today in our world. And Spotlight does such a great, it's such a great choice to highlight as a devastating choice. Great, I mean, in a...
Yeah, I just made a fool of myself crying so hard during the credits. People probably thought I was molested by a priest. I was crying so hard during the credits.
They should put that on the poster. but yes, it's such a necessary part of the movie to say, like, this one instance of reporting this story was not the end of something. It was the beginning, right? And so many movies, The Post, Trial of Chicago 7, like a lot of movies, I feel like to act as though when the credits roll, it's that thing of like, and then everything was good for the rest of time forever. And
yeah,
it's important. The point of this movie is to show that it is not.
Yeah. The one character who gets a postscript in the epilogue is Cardinal Law, who received a promotion and died in a Roman villa 15 years later, who also spent the bulk of his promoted career in Vatican City going after nun groups who were espousing liberal causes in America. That was his big concern in his, like, valedictory period as a high up cardinal. Mm-hmm. He received no punishment for anything that happened. And I can't, everybody, to stray away from the movie would be a never-ending podcast, and I would just vent about this whole thing.
To finish up talking about that, the ending choice of the final crawl, or the way they reveal it as well, which is really simple, but like, I remember sitting in that theater, and I'm sure this is the impact it had on anybody sitting in, like, the dark theater, but, like, just the white text on the black screen, and it flashes the one, like, group of, you know, it still is in this many states or this many cities, and then it flashes, like, the rest of the cities around the world and the country, and it's the way it keeps
so going. Much more than you think it's going to be.
Right. It's a really powerful, impactful reveal.
It gives you, like, the one sentence of text, this was uncovered in the following cities, beat, and then three columns.
Yes.
For four frames.
Right.
It's so much more than you think it's going to be. Even 15 years on, even after all the reporting that's been done, even when, if you approach to the point where, like, now, if you approached a person on the street and you said Catholic priest, then what's the first thing that came into your mind? They would probably say child molester.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that would be the biggest part of the word cloud. Even after all that, it still is surprising that so many places.
I guess this might be a tough question because of where you were when this was happening. But do you think now, do you think the movie has informed more people about this issue than the actual reporting of the original story?
I don't think so. No, okay. I think this is one of like the bigger like domestic. Well, it wasn't domestic. But I would say it's like one of the big cultural developments over the last like 20 years.
Right.
Okay. I was coaching basketball in my high school I was a high school student and I was coaching basketball at my middle school. And the first year I didn't have to do any like safe space training. And the following year I did.
Okay.
Like it was pretty instantaneous. I was lying about going to church at this period of time, so I can't tell you what it was like to like be in Sunday mass while this was all happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly didn't talk about it with my parents, who have quite interesting views on this whole thing now. And again, I can't get into it.
Yes.
Yeah. Exhausting. But
what's the old movie tagline? Like, it should be like, we're going to do to Catholic churches what Jaws did to beaches. I'm just pitching them what should go on their poster at this point.
But. Yeah. And I mean, I remember reading reviews of Spotlight and like looking forward to podcast discussions about, oh gosh, the monstrosity of this crime. But probably the right critical way to look at this movie is not through the lens of this specific issue, because that's what documentaries are for. The right critical way to look at this movie is like, through the filmmaking choices and like, is it compelling? Do you understand what's happening and all of that? And that was generally how it went. I remember being like, consistently disappointed because I kind of wanted like these fire breathing denunciations of all the shit that was allowed to happen. And the very succinct way that the movie shows you how it could happen and how it did happen and how it just everybody is culpable. Mm-hmm. And like, I saw Val, the documentary today, but Val Kilmer.
Yes.
And like he gets tarred as like a difficult presence on set. And I can't really speak to that, but there's like a scene of, there's like a little tiny flash of Robert Downey Jr. at one point saying, everybody, you know, everybody just started calling him difficult and now he's difficult, even though it's complete bullshit. Like he was speaking about that period of time on Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which as far as Robert Downey Jr. is concerned, went great. And like, you don't meet Mitch Garabedian, Tucci's character, after you've heard character after character saying how eccentric he is and how weird he is and how off the reservation he is. And like, I wonder who started those rumors.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one of many areas where, like you see what we were talking, you don't need the black SUVs following the characters at night. There are just so many ways that, in this case, the church, having such a prime place in Boston society, is able to like exert its influence in totally nonviolent ways that no one would think about. And like as far as the run-on effects, I feel like it's never been more alienating to like be a man who enjoys hanging out with children in like a coaching fashion and like a mentoring fashion in any kind of way at all. Everybody is just always suspicious. And like, it's because of scandals like these, everybody just automatically assumes you're the absolute worst. Whenever I got shit in college for coaching a basketball team of middle schoolers, and I mentioned it to like barbers in Atlanta, and they're like, I would be interested in doing something like that, but I can't help thinking it's weird. Like the run-on effects of this kind of thing, they just continue to make everybody's life worse.
Yeah.
Fucking sucks. Anything else on Spotlight?
No, I think we covered a lot. And I think, again, just like overall, you know, take the prestige of Oscar awards out of it. It is just a compelling, captivating movie that just moves, you know? So I'd recommend it to anybody. Atop the weightiness of the subject matter, it is still just like, totally watchable.
It's got to be said, too, like, official Catholic organizations, the church itself, they also endorse this movie. Like, they have no quibbles with this movie, including Jenkins, Richard Jenkins' voiceover, like, his character, talking a lot about how just, like, chastity is ridiculous, and it's a poison pill at the center of the church that creates a culture of secrecy. Even that, they don't quibble with. There were protests for, like, Last Temptation of Christ, which is not an anti-Christian movie at all. I've never understood that. But plenty of Catholics denounced that movie. And, you know, however many years later, like, Spotlight is getting the stamp of approval from this league and that league. So I guess that you would call that progress. But, of course, at the time of its release, Bernard Law is still sitting in his comfortable villa in Rome. There's a scene in Spotlight, and this will be the last thing we say, where Michael Keaton is, like, sitting with various school officials at this high school that they all went to, wondering, like, did anybody know about this one priest who was here and who has accusations against him? Did you have that? And, like, I went to school in a period before the scandal, and you went to school after it. So those are very different worlds. But did you have that, like, teacher that everybody was like, you need to stay away from that guy?
So no, like, luckily, no, not to any, like, serious degree. I will say, just, like, as a teacher now, unfortunately, like, you do just hear stories, and it happens, unfortunately. I will say my dad did grow up in a Jesuit high school.
Mm-hmm.
And years later, like, at his, like, 40th reunion or whatever, yeah, that might be too many years, but, like, you know, that is one of his, like, reunions, later found out, talking to, like, a teacher who was still around that he knew, that, like, this other teacher was fired for doing inappropriate whatever. It was that thing of, like, 30 years later or whatever, piecing it together and being like, holy shit, like,
yeah,
that was happening. So it does happen, but luckily not to me or anyone I personally know.
My high school, the athletic director, who doubled as a PE coach, was known to spend an inappropriate amount of time in the locker room.
Yikes.
Yeah. But everybody knew, everybody that had, he would have had, like, half the freshman class, because you were required to take PE for, like, the first three semesters. Everybody just understood this was a fact of life for this guy. And this would have been, like, 98, 99. So who knows if this guy still would have been allowed to linger in a couple years later. I don't know. My three semesters were done. I don't know. I remember who was teaching PE at that point. But just so much of this rings so true, Spotlight, to the point where, much like Captain Fantastic, to a lesser degree and to a degree that I trust more, at a certain point, this movie just overwhelms, like, any of my critical faculties, and it's just like a time machine. It's a great movie. It's a great movie. Everybody needs to watch this. It's a great movie. Mm-hmm. It's an important movie. And speaking of important movies, our next three movies that have been selected for the Munich Movie Club are Blade, Blade 2, and Blade Trinity. So we decided we wanted to do a trilogy of movies and Blade won this month. So that's what we're watching. Thoughts on Blade before you revisit, Pierce?
How do you think seen a Blade
movie. Oh, fun.
So yeah, I guess now I have to watch them.
Oddly important movies, black lead superhero, kind of like the first of that whole era. You could pin a lot of it on Blade, so thank you, Blade, ?
The first Marvel movie.
Yes, unless you count, like, terrible Fantastic Four from a few years earlier,
right? And maybe Howard the Duck technically, but
we will also be putting out some Sopranos focused episodes in the next few weeks. We're gonna try and do four of those before the release of Many Saints of Newark, which comes out early October. And we're gonna talk about the Sopranos from like a mafia standpoint and from Tony's family standpoint. And then we're also going to talk about some of the bad episodes and the trippy episodes and trying to decipher what was going on in that in Costa Mesa, wherever Tony's coma dreams happened. In the meantime, you can read our reviews of these movies and many more at MuticaMovie.club. You can like us on Facebook at Mutica Movie Club, follow us on Twitter at Mutica Movical, and Instagram at Mutica Movie Club as well. Thank you for joining me tonight, Pierce.
Yeah.
Have a good night.
All right.